My name is Larry Collins. I'm a geologist in the village with another geologist. And if you see Rick Dunning or myself around anywhere, you can ask me questions about rocks and minerals or about the mine. And if I don't know the answer, I can tell you a story at least. All right, we're going to proceed rather quickly now because I have a lot of slides to show you. And we're going to begin with the Garden of Eden. And this is a quote from Genesis 2. And the river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it was parted and became four heads. The name of the first is Pishon, that is it which compasses the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold, and the gold of that land is good. There is bdellium and onyx stone. And the name of the second river is Gihon, the same as that compasses the whole land of Cush. And the name of the third river is Hiddekel, that is, it goes toward the east of Assyria. And the fourth river is Euphrates. Now, the Pishon River is probably the Wadi al-Batan that comes in from the Precambrian rocks in Arabia. Wadi means dry riverbed. And it's the cradle of gold, onyx. Onyx is probably either marble or emeralds or rubies or sapphires, anyway, something that's precious like that. And bdellium is probably a fragrant resin, somewhat like myrrh or frankincense. Gihon River is probably the Karun River that comes in from Iran. The Hiddekel River is the Tigris River in Iraq that extends west to Assyria. And the Euphrates River is bisects the center of Iraq. And the confluence of these four rivers is at the head of the Persian Gulf near Basra. And so now I can show you where the Garden of Eden is. Okay. Here is the Persian Gulf. There's the Karun River coming in right here. Here's the Tigris River coming in there. Euphrates River comes in here. Here is the Wadi al-Batan coming down here. It's completely dry now. But there's sand dunes over the top here and sand dunes over there. But from aerial satellite images, you can trace that river through that area, even underneath the sand dunes. This is the contact here between the Precambrian rocks over here and the rocks here. Right here is probably the gold mine of Solomon, which they estimate that they took out 620,000 ounces of gold. Tremendous source of gold. But now you can see right in here is where the confluence of those four rivers are, is where the Garden of Eden is. All right, we can look at this again. Here is the Persian Gulf, the Karun River coming in. The Tigris River comes down through here. It comes right through the city of Baghdad there, about 25 miles west of there. The Euphrates River comes down here, joins at this point and comes out there. Here's the Wadi al-Batan coming in. There's the city of Basra. Somewhere right in here is the Garden of Eden. That is likely the place where Noah constructed his ark. All right? So right here in the southeastern part of Mesopotamia, now the country of Iraq. All right. There are actually four records of a large flood, probably about 2900 BC. You're all familiar with the Bible, the Genesis, the chapters 6 and 9, where Noah is said to have built a large ark, which he brought animals and his family put on it. But there's almost a duplicate story here in the Muslim Bible, the Quran, in Surahs chapter 7 and 71. There's somebody whose name sounds very much like Noah. There was a big ark structure, just like the one that Noah built. They brought animals to it, so it's almost a duplicate story. Okay? But there are two older stories back in Babylonian history. The Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh, which was a big flood on the Euphrates River. And then there's the Babylonian Epic of Atrahasis, which is a large flood on the Tigris River.
Good question.
Yes.
When was the Epic of Atrahasis?
These are probably around a little bit older than 2900 BC. I don't have a date. Okay, I just know that it's older. All right. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, the gods were very unhappy with the humans because they were making too much noise, and they decided to destroy them with a large flood. And one of the gods told Gilgamesh that if he wanted to save himself and his family, he needed to build a large boat to put his cattle on in order to survive that flood. Does that sound familiar? In the Epic of Atrahasis, there was a large flood which came down, and the people at that time built their villages right along the Tigris River as a source where they could fish, because the floodplains were pretty swampy. And when the flood came and rose above the level of the villages, he had no choice but to take his family and get into his boat and float down the river to the Gulf of Persia. And when the flood finally dried out, got out of his boat and on dry land and built an altar to make sure that the water god didn't do this again. Does that sound familiar? At any rate, when Noah got out on dry land, he also built an altar Yahweh, so it wouldn't happen again. All right. The storms that come into that part of the country come in from three directions, with the main arrow here. The Zagros Mountains are right here. They come in from Mediterranean Sea. They are funneled down through this way because of the Zagros Mountains and tend to go out the Persian Gulf there. This is the main direction because of cyclic, sometimes the winds come in from this way, but mainly it's in that direction. All right. I want to call your attention to a village here called Hit, which we'll look at another time. Here's the city of Baghdad. This is high country all the way around in Turkey, Syria, Saudi Arabia. The Euphrates and Tigris rivers coming down through here come down at this point. It's about 175 feet above sea level. Sea level is right down here. When you get to the city of Baghdad, the elevation of the river is about 100 feet above sea level. There is another city here we'll look at in a little bit, which is As-Samarra, which is about 175 miles south of Baghdad. The elevation there is only 30 feet above sea level, and then down here is at sea level. Okay? Now, the gradients of the floodplains around there, if we start at 175 feet elevation, about 80 miles north of Baghdad, the elevation at Baghdad is 100 feet, so the gradient is only about a foot per mile. That's pretty flat. That's almost flat. Would you agree with me? All right. Then from Baghdad at 100 feet, 174 miles south of As-Samarra, it drops to 30 feet. The gradient now is 0.4 feet per mile. Let's get in even flatter. And then from As-Samarra, it drops from 30 feet, traveling 223 miles to the Persian Gulf, and now the gradient is down to 0.13 feet per mile. That is very flat. All right, north of the Garden of Eden, the combined floodplain widths of those two rivers is 175 miles wide. The elevation between the Euphrates and the Tigris, the highest land between those, is only 25 feet above the level of the rivers. Okay? And that there's a ridge that slopes toward the Persian Gulf between those rivers, which then drops down to the floodplain between the two of them. And now we have a width, the combined width is 175 miles wide. All right, now let's look at the biblical flood history. It says that the rains lasted 40 days. The waters prevailed on the earth for 150 days. Then the waters gradually receded by the seventh month and the 17th day, Noah's ark is said to have rested on the mountains of Ararat. Not on Mount Ararat, it's on the mountains of Ararat. Okay? And then 1 year and 2 months and 27 days later, the earth finally dried out enough for Noah and his family and animals to disembark from the ark. Now, if you read the Bible, it says that the intended purpose of the flood was to destroy all flesh. Okay? And so on that basis, those who take a literal interpretation of the Bible say that all of the fossils of the dead animals in all the sedimentary rocks worldwide must be that destroyed flesh. And on that basis, they say the whole earth was covered with water. Does that make sense to you? All right, so we have a whole earth flood based on the fossils in all of the sedimentary rocks that are everywhere.
So the sedimentary rocks suggest that there's been a flood there?
On the basis that all of these sedimentary rocks have fossils in it, which are supposed to represent the flesh that's been destroyed. Are you with me? All right. All right. So here I just put on to show you that surrounding the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, there's high land all the way around here. And it's this area right here where we have almost flat surface. Okay, now what's the problem with this scientifically? This is a cross-section through where you can see the Kuran River, the Tigris, the Euphrates coming in, and across here is Wadi Abatan. There's where Noah would have built his ark. Well, underneath that place, there's 30,000 feet of sedimentary rocks with fossils in it. That's prior to when he built his boat. So it's impossible then to have a worldwide flood if you've already got sedimentary rocks with fossils in it under. Here is the city of Hit, and there is a vertical fault right there, and petroleum oil has come up to the surface, and the volatile part of the oil has evaporated to leave a tar or pitch. And this place is well known in that part of the country where they got their pitch to fit into the cracks in the boats to put them together. So that would have been where Noah got his pitch to seal the cracks. And that's, of course, sitting on sedimentary rock, okay, with fossils in it. Here is the Precambrian rock over here on this side. There's 30,000 feet of sedimentary rocks with fossils in it. All right. Almost 50 years ago, here are two salt miners. There's my wife and myself 50 years ago. We were visiting a salt mine in Salzburg, Austria, obviously, and we went down in the mine as tourists, and the salt layers there are probably 400 feet thick in Devonian sediment. Okay. Well, associated with... Well, let me explain to you what happens to get that salt. If you start with a body of seawater and isolate it so that it has no connection with the main ocean, so that evaporation can occur, if that body of seawater has 3.5% dissolved salts in it, if 50% of it evaporated, then you start to precipitate calcium carbonate. If 80% evaporates, then you start to precipitate gypsum, which is calcium sulfate with a little bit of water in it. When you get 90% evaporation, that's when you begin to precipitate salt. And with 98% evaporation, you get other salts of potassium and magnesium there. Worldwide, you always see this same sequence. Okay? And I'll tell you that there are places where you get these evaporite sequences where there's as much as 3,000 feet of it. Okay? Worldwide. And now we want to take a little bit more look at this now. Associated with these evaporite deposits are red beds. This one isn't particularly red here, but there are red beds which have fossilized mud crack prints in them. The only way you can get mud cracks is to have that shale or that mud exposed to the air so evaporation occurs and the mud shrinks because of the evaporation and you develop cracks. Blowing sand or sediment comes in and fills in those cracks. The rock is hardened, and now we have fossilized mud crack prints. They are red because the mud contains a fair amount of iron minerals in it, which exposed to the oxygen, to the air, exposed to oxygen there, oxidizes to make hematite, which is red. Okay? These mud crack prints are associated with all of those evaporite deposits. Another clue that we're dealing with a time of evaporation. All right, just to emphasize again now, the only time that we see that dry earth occurs is at the end of the flood, and Noah is waiting for the earth to dry out to get out of his boat, his ark on dry land. Therefore, if this is a worldwide flood, and that's the time when evaporation occurs, we should expect to find those salt layers on top of all the other sedimentary rocks that were deposited by the flood. And what we find out is that these salt layers are through all of, in many continents, maybe some of you from Michigan, there's a big salt layer there that they do mining there. All continents have salt layers in them, some of which are 3,000 feet thick, and they are different layers within the sequence. Not on top, but at different places everywhere. So if we look at, compare the flood geology and the modern geology, the drying was the last event, but here in what we see is we get multiple cycles of drying, multiple times when isolated seas got caught. And we have evaporites deposited at many different levels. Here they'd have to be all at the same age on top. And then, of course, you could have red beds and fossil mud crack prints in either place, but you can't have drying in the midst of a flood. You can't have evaporite sequences. This is a definite clue, scientifically, that a whole Earth flood didn't occur. All right, there's also another reason why we can come to this. It's because of the curvature of the Earth. As you look across the horizon, there's a point where the horizon, because of the curvature of the Earth, drops out of sight. And the formula is C equals 2/3 times X squared, where C is the curvature, the drop in feet, and X is the distance in miles. If I were 6 feet 3 inches tall, my eye level would be about 6 feet above the surface, and as I looked across toward the horizon and plugged in this formula there, in 3 miles the horizon has dropped out of view. Okay, are you with me? And if someone was looking 45 miles away, at that point, the horizon would have dropped 1,176 feet. It isn't long before everything is out of view. All right? But supposing I was standing up on top of an ark, and the ark is 45 feet high and about a third of it is below water, then we can plug in these formulas and see how far we could see the horizon drop instead of three miles it drops out of sight. Because I'm standing at a higher level, the horizon drops at 7.35 miles away instead of, because of my greater height on the boat. But again, as it turns out, that anything where we could see land, some of the lands might be 50 feet above the sea level or somewhere down there, but the river, the whole floodplain is 175 miles wide. So this means that anybody on that ark looking would see nothing but water in all directions. That person's world would be underwater. His whole world would be, and that was the whole world for these people. Okay? All right, this again says that right here is likely where Noah's flood occurred, and this was the whole world for these people. All right, there is an archaeological record through in this area for Mesopotamia. And there is in Mesopotamia, in this area, multiple records of floods in different levels. And there is one that's been dated archaeologically to be 2900 BC, which is about 11 feet thick. That's likely the flood that was the big one. However, that would be about right here. But if you look at the archaeological periods in Egypt or Assyria or wherever, at that period of time, instead of a record of a big flood, those people in Egypt and Assyria had problems with drought. There's no record of a big flood at that time. So that suggests to me that the flood was very local, okay? Because it isn't recorded anyplace else. All right, Noah's Ark is shown in many different ways. Some constructed with a rectangular shape. Here is another possible view of how the ark is constructed. And I want to report to you that there is a what appears to the creationists, the young earth literalists, that there is a structure right here where you see this point here that looks like could be fossilized Noah's Ark. It's about 17 miles south of Mount Ararat. I'll show you this little village over here of Kazan, and I'll come back and refer to it. But at any rate, right here is what they thought was a fossilized ark. And it has this shape. It looks somewhat rounded at the one end and pointed at the other. And it's in the middle of a very large landslide. And this is that large landslide. Coming down here, right there is supposedly Noah's Ark. And the idea is that Ark at one time was higher up in the mountains of Ararat, and it broke loose and was brought down by this landslide to this present position. All right, there is a man named David Fossild who was a merchant marine officer who learned about this site and came there to look at it, and his interpretation was that the ark had that shape when it was built, much like the Egyptians build their reed boats with reeds to hold it together. And he wrote this book, The Ark of Noah. When I convinced him that his ideas were all wrong, his book was so popular at that time that in comparison to the Bible, which I think was number one worldwide as the most sought after book, his book was number 15 worldwide. When I explained to him why it could not be, he had to stop his publisher from publishing any more copies, and also to stop translating it into many different languages. I cost him thousands and thousands of dollars.
When was that book written?
1988. And he is the only creationist that I've contacted in 35 years who had the integrity to say I'm wrong and changed his mind. Everybody else that I've contacted who have a literal creationist view, they are dead set that they can't change their mind. Okay. Here is what it looks like. And you can see people walking around on the surface of it. They were in the process of stretching yellow lines here to get some guide and measuring different things. Those lines were supposedly places where they found iron oxide remnants. They used a metal detector. And with the metal detector, they get a sudden signal, and they would look down there, and the metal detector would see a piece of rusty-looking iron, which in some places looked like a piece of washer or a rivet or actually an iron bracket. And so these people concluded that Noah must have had a forge at some point and produced iron back there to make various things to hold the walls together. Okay? And he claimed that in some part of the Bible you can find a place where they actually refer to iron back in there. To my knowledge, Iron Age is much later than this. All right. Okay, this is David Fossild. He's the man. His mother was a member of a fundamentalist church who believed in a literal interpretation, and David Fossild said that it would be a feather in his cap if he could show that this was actually Noah's Ark, a fossilized remains of it. All right, here's another view. And one of the reasons why they thought that this was Noah's Ark is that the distance from here to here is 515 feet long. If you use the Egyptian cubit, which is 23.8 inches long, instead of the Hebrew cubit, which is 18 inches long, a cubit is the distance from the tip end of your finger to your elbow. Okay. Since Moses is attributed to writing the Genesis stories, and because he was in Egypt and trained by Egyptians, the logical thing to conclude is that he used the Egyptian cubit instead of the Hebrew cubit. And as it turns out, 515 is exactly equal to 300 cubits long, and that was pretty good evidence to these people that it must be Noah's Ark. But as I say, well, I should say now, that David Fossil, after 8 years of investigating this, began to wonder whether all of the other creationists that came here were giving him bad advice. They told him that all of these rocks, oops, bingo, the wrong one, all of the rocks in here, the rims of it, the deck rocks, the walls that were in here, and the gunnels on either side were composed of fossilized wood. And so on that advice, he assumed that he must be right because that was there. But he began to get suspicious that maybe they didn't know what they were talking about. And so he collected 12 samples of various places from end to tip and across here and the gunnels, and smuggled them out of Turkey. That was illegal. If he'd been caught, he would have all kinds of problems. He took a sample of an iron bracket, cut it in half, gave half to a man named Dr. John Baumgartner. Well, I'll have to back up. I'll tell you about that in a moment. And when I made thin sections of that to see if it was fossilized wood, I should have seen something like this. This is what fossilized wood looks like. You can see the cellular structure. What was I actually found is that all the samples were sections of volcanic rock. And you can see the laths of plagioclase feldspar in here, of various sizes, holes in there where vesicles from the expansion of the steam that was present, and then little tiny grains of black material in here which are magnetite. Magnetite is an iron oxide. It will give cause a detector to give an iron signal. If those magnetite grains are washed by streams and concentrated in local areas, it'll be a placer magnetite deposit. Some of those places will fill in cracks, and it may develop a right angle appearance of a bracket or whatever it might be there. Okay? All right. So he went around and he found places where there were concentrations of magnetite there, and those were supposed to be places where trusses of the boat supported the ark. But what he found here is at the end of the places, you've got streamers of places parallel that give an iron detection. And what in the world were these streamers of material doing out beyond the bark? It didn't make any sense. All right, so here is the foot or the end of the boat here, and magnetite is being washed out down here and giving the signal. It's eroding out from the shales and the muds in here and from the rocks that's being weathered. And so that was what was giving the signal there of iron, and had nothing to do with what was inside the boat. All right, this is Dr. John Baumgartner. He has a PhD degree in geophysics from UCLA. He was there, and when they found this thing that looked like an iron bracket, he assured David Fossil that that was real iron. It was a rusty piece. And because this guy had a PhD degree, who's going to argue with a PhD? Okay. This man's undergraduate work is in electrical engineering. He's never had any basic background in understanding geology and what minerals look like. And they never bothered to take samples until they did this right here. Okay? And this is what that sample looked like. I've got a thin section. Whoops, went the wrong way on this thing. I'm using the wrong pointer here. You can see the right angle bend. It's a very rusty looking material. And John Baumgartner took his half back to Los Alamos to do a chemical analysis. And this is what he found. It's mostly iron, 76 to 89%, but it contains some titanium and some aluminum and magnesium and manganese in there. And so they concluded that NOAA had the ability to make alloys out of titanium and aluminum at that time. Okay? Not only that, other creationists who've sampled this and sent them off to a reputable place to do analyses, and some of these places where they reported as elements and not oxides. So these creationists have said, oh, look, obviously these are alloys. Well, they sent it in as a metal piece, and so they reported the metals that were in it. And that's not normally how you do it, and there's no way that this could be an alloy. Yes?
Is Oh, I was in Britain.
Okay. And when I made a thin section of this, that bracket, these are little grains of magnetite that are oxidizing to limonite, which is the iron oxide, which is rust. And in between here, you can see silicate minerals that have magnesium and aluminum in it. So it's quite apparent the reason why it gives this analysis. So you've got titaniferous magnetite weathering out, and now people are claiming that this is something that NOAA built. All right. I've never been there. On the basis of what he showed me, I suggested that this was, could have been what had happened. That is, you have a folded rock which is eroded into what we would call a doubly plunging syncline. It's a canoe shape. And two other geologists who have been there told me it is not this. And they said it probably has a different origin. And since I've not been there, I trust their ability of observation. I'll take their advice. And one of the possibility is that this is actually bedrock here and hasn't slid anywhere. And it's been shaped in this shape because, or eroded into this shape because of the landslide that went around this bedrock. That's one possibility. I think it needs further study to really decide what happened. I should tell you at this point that there are three other structures besides this one which has this shape that's just south of Mount Ararat, and that suggests to me that maybe NOAA had three other arcs that he had with him. Okay? It's very likely, and I'm convinced that this is a natural structure, geologic structure, and is not a fossilized remains. All right? Well, associated with this thing is drogue stones. These are actual Egyptian drogue stones, which the Egyptians used in their boats that were constructed with reeds. And what they would do is they would construct the boat such that there was a hollow area or a well that they could drop the drogue stones right down through the center of the boat as a drag. Okay? Using those drogue stones, if a storm came up, it would drag the boat around so it would face the waves, so that the waves wouldn't come in from the side and wash it over. Okay? You get what I'm saying? All right. You will note here that these are probably 200 or 300 pound weight, that the holes in these are quite a ways from the rim there to make sure that they don't break loose. At the city of Kazan, you find about 10 to 14 of what were supposed to be drogue stones that NOAA somehow dropped off from his ark. And you'll notice that this bone stone here, drogue stone that they thought, is about 20,000 pounds. There are others that are about 4,000 pounds. Enormous weight. Okay? Many of these drogue stones, this is broken loose right there. Obviously, it doesn't have the strength. You will see on the surface of this crosses. At one time, these drogue stones were probably some kind of structures that were in a pagan cemetery. And then later the Christians took them over and carved crosses on them. If this is a pagan cemetery, those holes could be the eye of a dragon as a possibility. It could be a place where they put candles or something. Some people have suggested that if they were lined in such a way, they could have been something for an astronomical sighting device. We really don't know. Okay? I have a thin section of that. It's composed of a rock that we call an orthosite, which is primarily all plagioclase feldspar with lots and lots of magnetite in it. There is no such stone in Mesopotamia anywhere where NOAA would have built the ark for 500 miles. And it weighs so much, they're not likely that this is where it came from. This has probably come from a local quarry somewhere close by because all the rocks around there are volcanic. But nobody's really taken the time to look for it. Okay? All right. Other literalists, creationists, say, well, that's not the ark. The ark must have landed on the top of Mount Ararat. Mount Ararat is almost 17,000 feet high. I need to tell you that underneath Mount Ararat is several thousand feet of sedimentary rock with fossils in it. If this has occurred when Noah was in his ark, you'd have to deposit all of those sedimentary rocks, sediments, and harden them into rocks. And then you would have to punch through there, volcanic lava, to build on top of this volcanic mountain to as high as 17,000 feet. And then you'd have to have it cool and harden before Noah could land on top of it. That's physically impossible. Okay? Are you with me? But nevertheless, I've gotten at least five creationists who've sent me photographs who are sure they found Noah's Ark poking out from the glaciers there. And this is an example of one of them. And he tells me right there is where Noah's Ark, a remnant, is poking out from underneath the glacier. Okay? And there it is. Okay? That's Noah's Ark poking out there. If you're not convinced, we have an enhanced view of it, and you can see the windows and the door right there. Okay? And my wife says, if you look close, you can see a camel poking his head up. From my experience as a geologist, that's vertical joining, which is very common in volcanic rock. Okay? Besides this place, that same person told me that another person climbed up and looked down into a canyon, and there is a rectangular-shaped rock there. And he was sure it was a beam from Noah's Ark. Again, this is very likely a rectangular block that breaks loose, which is common in volcanic rock. None of these people have ever climbed down and got an actual sample of that or any other place. It's just too dangerous. So until they can come back and give me a sample that I can show is petrified wood, I have great doubt. Okay. All right. This is a view of bristlecone pine trees in the Panamint Mountains of California. There's a live tree here. Here's one that's dead. You can core these trees and use dendrochronology. That is, you can look at the tree rings and the spacings and whatever, and they're different from year to year depending upon the weather. And using live ones and dead ones, you can make a template of the ages in which these things were growing, and we can find there that you have living and dead trees that are 8,300 years old. Many of these creationists say the earth is formed 6,000 years ago, so we got a problem there. There is a space in the record, and you can find still older tree stumps, which we can date by carbon-14, and these are 10,000 years old age. Okay? Now, this is at Two Creeks, Wisconsin. Those of you that were here earlier in the week, I showed you something that looked like this, and that's glacial till. It's unsorted and unstratified. Underneath that till, you'll find Douglas fir logs. A stream is working headward into this, eroding out the till, exposing these logs underneath the till. By carbon-14 dating techniques, those logs are 10,000 years in age. This tells me that the Ice Age, the latest one, was still in Canada just 10,000 years ago. And as that glacier retreated, melted back, a Douglas fir forest grew at its margin, but for some reason the ice readvanced and went over the top of the forest and buried the trees there, and there's so much clay in that till, it sealed these trees from any oxidation and they're preserved. And I have seen samples of this rock and looked on these logs, and they look just like Douglas fir trees, except they're a little bit carbonized. Okay? So you can have logs that last 10,000 years, okay? Just like the bristlecone pines. All right, this is just a repeat to show you that you've got 17,000 feet and all of these sedimentary rocks with fossils on it underneath the volcano, and it's resting on Precambrian granite just like down in Mesopotamia. All right. I need to point out to you that in modern times of science, we tend to think like the Greeks. We're scientists. We think precisely. And the numbers have exact numerical meanings. But when we read the Bible, we need to think like Hebrews, okay, who use numerology. And they give numbers or holy meaning as sacred symbols. And the numbers 3, 6, and 7. 7 means perfection. There's 12 and 40. There's at least 24 times in which 40 is used in the Bible. As a scientist, I have very doubts that it was exactly 40. There could have been 41 or 47 or whatever, but 40 has a very definite holy meaning, and so that's what they used. So to me, it means just a very long time. They also use multiples of these numbers, like 14, 60, 300, 360, 600, 3600. They also used the sexagesimal system, which used numbers of 60. This is why we have a circle that's divided up into 360 degrees, 60 minutes, 60 seconds. Okay. At any rate, Noah is, at the time of the flood, is said to be 600 years old. I guess if you think Hebrew, if a very old person is somebody who's very wise, because he's lived that long, he can remember more than anybody else. And to emphasize that he is very wise, you say he is 600 years old. Okay? So it doesn't necessarily mean that he was that long. The number 300 here, which is the length of the cubits in the boat, that could have had sacred meaning. To make it that long, it could have been a large boat, but not necessarily 300. Okay? All right. And I want to point out to you this quote from Goethe, who says, "We only see what we know." And to prove my point here, I want to get my glasses on, and I want to read from 1 Genesis here. And in the beginning, when God created the heavens and earth, and I'm quite sure, as you think, that you see what you know, and therefore there must be lenses in here, and there's nothing in here. Okay? You saw lenses because that's what you know should be there. And we creationists are sure that if the earth is 6,000 years, when you walk out this building, all these mountains were created 6,000 years ago because that's what they see. Okay? They don't think in terms of the evidence. Whoops, I better get rid of my glasses here. All right, what am I grabbing? Here you are. So geologists have to look at all the data. They don't selectively choose some data and ignore other data. If you just choose what you want to fit your model, then you can prove anything. But I have to choose all the data, and I have to be precise in what I do. And so I'm suggesting to you that Noah's flood was likely local, that there was a big flood, but that not necessarily covered the whole earth. In Genesis, we have there mention of the firmament. I wish the creationists would be consistent. If they're going to translate things literally, firmament means a solid dome that's over the earth, which rotated above a flat earth surface, and from that dome were hanging lights, like ceiling lights, the stars, and through that area the sun and the moon and the stars move. Okay? In that period of time, the heavens were supposed to be perfect, because that's when where God was supposed to live. Okay, I forgot to mention the Tower of Babel. To convince you that this is the model that they have, that God was up in the heavens, some early tribes decided to build a tower so they could get up to the top of the dome and see where God was. And that was the Tower of Babel. Okay? So they had this idea in mind. Okay, everything in the heavens were supposed to be perfect. The sun was supposed to be perfect, a perfect circle. The moon was supposed to be a perfect circular shape. And Galileo discovered that the sun had sunspots on it, which actually rotated around as the sun turned. That the moon had mountains on it, which wasn't supposed to be. That Jupiter had four moons instead of one. Three more than what the Earth was. We were supposed to be the center of the universe. And he told some of his friends who doubted all this, said, "Come look through my telescope, I'll show you these moons." And he said, "Oh no, you might be witches and we might see them." Okay? And then with his telescope, he discovered the Milky Way had billions of stars in it. It just wasn't a smear of lights there. And now we know with our powerful telescopes that there are galaxies beyond this with billions and billions of stars in it, and billions of galaxies, and we no longer think of the firmament as a solid place. So if they're going to translate things literally, they should stick to this, and they don't. They only choose the data that they want to see. All right. I want to say also that they interpreted Genesis story as an actual record of the creation of the heavens and earth. And I don't think that is the question that was the author of Genesis was trying to answer. That is, at that period of time, the local tribes around there were worshiping pagan gods, and these pagan gods, there was a night god, there was a daytime god, a sun god, a moon god, star god, animal god, water god, and all of them were feared because these gods were about to get them. They had to build altars to these various gods. And the author of Genesis says, no, no, these are not gods. There's only one God, and he created all of this. You don't need to be afraid of these gods. Okay? So I think that is the purpose of Genesis, is to demonstrate that there's only one God, and these things are not out to get people. All right, I think I'll stop there and hope I've made a convincing talk, and we'll see what you have to say. Boy, stunned silence.
You would build a case for a limited flood.
Yes.
From geological evidence.
From geological evidence. That there was a likely a flood, and then from that, there developed a story that made sense to the people of that time. But not necessarily that it's scientifically accurate. I do not read the Bible as a science text. I read it for its theology. In my view, I am committed as a Christian. I'm out to follow Jesus. In the Old Testament, there still was a judgmental God, which they were afraid of. And it wasn't until Jesus came along and said, oh no, you don't have to follow laws. This is the wrong way to go. God is not a judgmental God. He's a God that exhibits love. And when Jesus died on the cross, he said, all of this has no sense. God loves you. Okay? That's my interpretation. And my God is a God of the universe, and I'm not confined to a single small box. He's more awesome than you can imagine. At least I can't imagine this guy, this creator. Okay? It's a wonderful creator we have. And if he can do things instead of by magic in 6,000 years, but do it over billions of years of time and have all of this fall into place, what a God we have.
Okay. Yes. To understand what you're saying, you sort of have to be able to think scientifically. I'm thinking like global warming, that there's a debate on that.
All right.
It's pretty easy to dismiss it if you don't understand the science. What percent of people, say in the United States, just our country, which is ostensibly educated, would you say have the wherewithal to understand even limited science like that?
I don't know.
More than half, less than half?
There is more than half of people in the United States who are sure that the literal interpretation occurs and that the flood actually exists. And I would say a very small percentage has ever been introduced to this. And even when I introduced to this, and I've been doing it for 35 years, I have a website in which I've presented my ideas. Even so, even though I presented complete logic, they say, oh no, we've got to believe in a perfect Bible, a perfect science text. And they say, God did it by a miracle. And I can't argue against a miracle.
A friend of mine, I live in Eugene, Oregon, he used to be one of the editors for the district record. And he was citing some study. I don't know what it is. But basically, if you take people and they don't have the wherewithal, they don't have, say, the same background as you, they really can't get it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like they're bad or
no.
They just that just doesn't make sense to them. So,
well,
I mean, if you're going to be logicking with using logic with some people that aren't logical, you know,
that's right.
You're heading us home.
I don't know what to do. I've tried for 35 years.
What is your website?
Rather than my trying to tell you, it's posted out there under the kiosk, and you can copy it. Yep.
Thank you. The question was a statement he made. I live in Houston, Texas, go to church, St. Martin's Lutheran Church, and our pastor has been teaching us for a long time, and most of the people in our congregation understand it. Mm-hmm. They don't have a scientific background. Mm-hmm.
Yet it is Texas where they're having the real problems with the creationists.
That's
because
true.
They're trying to get their interpretation into the textbooks.
Yes.
And Texas is the most, the biggest source in which science books are printed, and the publishers have to cater to them, and therefore their books, if it gets in there, it goes all over the United States, and it's going to perpetuate that.
Yeah, I know. I agree. I'm aware of that situation. I agree, and of course I totally disagree with that.
Yeah.
Approach.
You're next.
I was in college a long time ago. We looked at this and the whole world, I agree with you, the whole world covered by water just couldn't be. But I looked at what I had, by the way, I'm a historian, and my ancient history, and we were looking at that. Look at the cradle of civilization was the Tigris-Euphrates river valleys. And that area was underwater. And yeah, they would have been wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
So the story of Noah probably could be true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a biblical reference, as far as the times, I'm not so sure the biblical times are accurate. No, they could be not. I don't think it's all that important if they are or they aren't. And being a historian and a Christian, people are going up on Era trying to find evidence of Noah's Ark. I don't know why. I don't know what's going to prove.
And if it's so important to prove that, you're worshiping the Bible rather than Jesus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, is the story just another story to make a point? Or did it really happen?
Yeah.
You know, there's so many parables in the Bible to make a point. I agree with you. The flooding of the earth makes no sense at all. I mean, miracles are no miracles. It makes no logical sense to me. But the flooding of the valley, which most of us in the United States have dealt with floods, we know what they look like. We see them on TV. And the idea that, you know, this kind of thing happened makes more sense in this situation than it does in flooding the whole world.
Every culture has a flood story.
Yeah.
But it's probably a local flood story. Those who endured the tsunami in the South Pacific that washed over have a flood story. Those that were along the Mississippi River in about the 1950s when you had a great melding of ice and snow from a warm period, the Mississippi River flooded all over the place and drowned out cities along there. Those people have a flood story.
Well, like you said, this valley was their world.
Yep.
You know, anything beyond those mountains was a foreign place.
Yep.
You know, they traveled within that area.
Okay, I'll go to her and then I'll go to you.
So do you think that there was an actual Noah with an actual ark within this local area?
No, I think it's mythology to duplicate similar to the epics of Gilgamesh and whatever, but written in a way to make sense to the Hebrew people at that time. That would be my view. I don't know. Yep.
Do you find yourself within the scientific community having to defend the Bible as not being a scientific text? And is there a, you know, somewhat of a negative reaction because of the fact that it's a Bible of faith and not of science?
Well, you'll find both ways. You'll find some scientists, the person who can't think of his name right now, but he is the person who helped get the genome proved.
No, it's Francis Collins.
Francis Collins?
Yeah.
Thank you. That's what I'm trying to think of. He was an atheist and a physicist and he changed his view after being challenged by a woman in a hospital to take a look at it. And now this scientist who figured out the genome with a lot of other people is a committed Christian. He just says there's a bigger God. On the other hand, I've met people who are scientists who have become atheists, not so much because of, well, it's because of the churches that they've gone through that they see the hypocrisy of it, and that they're trying to force something down their throat that they say this can't be. And so I'm not going to have any part of that church because I've been given a brain and I'm expected to use it. Okay? So I find all ranges of some which are turned away from it, but it's primarily because of the narrow view of the churches that they've gone to. Yep. Oh, I'm sorry, you got first, now he gets a chance. Dave?
Oh, well, I was going to say, it's interesting to me because as a pastor trained in this church, I graduated from seminary in 82, so, you know, in a Lutheran seminary of that era, much less today, there wouldn't be any attempt at all to explain this text scientifically. I mean, we just say mythology, a story of meaning, theological, and we move on. So it's kind of the inverse reaction that you would get from a creationist. Right? We're trying to say there is science behind this? I mean, that's why my question is about the localization. And then your question, are you then trying to say there's a real no? Well, you're saying, well, no, that's a different kind of question. The geologist can't answer that question. Mm-hmm. But I could say there could have been a flood story here. So it's my thought for the keep me awake tonight is, what do we do to put some historicity back into the story? You know, maybe it's just the remnants of where it came from. It's interesting for me.
It's marvelous that in this story, these people were told that the rainbow was a promise. And that's nice theology, although it's not good science, but it's nice theology. You're next, and I'll come back to you.
Yeah. I would just add to that, not only in Lutheran seminaries, but I took some of my classes at Fuller in Pasadena, which is, I guess, on the left edge of the evangelical churches. And there was no attempt to approach the stories in the first 11 chapters of Genesis as history, but rather they were seen as adaptations of ancient traditions, ancient stories, that were seen to have a part to play in the author's greater purpose for setting up the story of Abraham. And so... I guess, you know, even including the non-fundamentalist end of the evangelical churches, I think you would find many that would be open to considering that the story isn't history, there's no way of answering the question of whether there was anyone named Noah, whatever kind of event lies behind the story, it's thousands upon thousands of years old, going way back into prehistory.
Good. I'm coming back to you, then I'll get you. I was
just going to make a little comment with a little light here, just getting awfully heavy. I don't know if there was a Noah or if there wasn't a Noah. And for me, it doesn't make a difference. I guess I believe there might have been a Noah. God said he spoke to Noah, so I'm not going to argue with that. But if there wasn't Noah, I have a bone to pick with him. Why didn't he swat those two mosquitoes?
I would point out to you that if this is a real thing, and that Noah's said to bring all of the animals, he had to get the kangaroo from Australia, the armadillo from Texas, the kangaroo, all of these different places. And after it landed, he's got to get them back there. And it's not, you're next, and then you.
I just think we do our children a disservice. in Sunday school, because I think we, whether we realize that we're doing it or not, I mean, I grew up in a Lutheran church my whole life, and I mean, we give our kids mobiles of Noah is 2x2 to hang above their cribs, and we give them the storybooks, and I mean, I really think we are teaching our children that this is the truth, and we maybe don't intend to do that, but I think we're doing it.
It's like teaching Santa Claus.
Hey! I just want to point out that this is not the only biblical story for which there's geological evidence of what happened. The one being I think of is the plagues of Egypt. Yes. There have been scientific and geological study on how some of that could have actually taken place. And one of the things that I've heard, and you may probably know more about it than I am, is that there were deposits of what was it, liquid methane or whatever nearby, which actually created a cloud of suffocation, and it spread over there, and it killed the firstborn because the firstborn were given a place of honor to sleep on the floor. And the stuff is heavier than air and oxygen, so it killed every single person on that. But it didn't kill the other born children. And actually, I saw that on PBS on the History Channel, I believe it was. Very, very fascinating. And also ideas about, of course, it's not really the Red Sea, but the Sea of Reeds, and how that may have happened, and actually how. There may have been lower sea level at that time. There may have been actually a horse that was exposed that they were able to get across to or whatever. And so this is not the only story which archaeologists are finding scientific evidence for and geologists as well.
I would agree.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, you're sort of debunking the literal interpretation of Noah through science. You could easily do the same thing for the virgin birth and the resurrection. I mean, it's kind of pick your story here.
Well, for me, these miracles are not the bottom line. And for me, the story of the virgin birth was written first probably 50 years later. I rather doubt that Mary told anybody about this. And I would point out to you that at that same time, all of the gods around there, which the Gentiles were worshiping, had virgin births and did miracles. And so these stories could be, say, well, our God is as good as your God, and he's even better. And they put these stories together such that they can tell some wonderful theology. And I don't have any problems with any of these miracles. They're not important. What's important is Jesus and his demonstration that God loves us. And I don't get hung up on miracles like some of my friends do. But I think that I'm just offering this as a possibility. Now you'll have to decide what you want to believe. Yep. Where? Up there.
Yeah. Well, this, you know, I'm not a scientist by any means, but you know, something that really got me thinking is, we look at science, of course, and you need to have absolute, you know, proof conceivably in drawing conclusions, or perhaps exhausting all the possibilities of why it couldn't be true, you know, and saying I don't know exactly what their realities were, at least at that point. But also, for me to be able to look also at logic, like for instance Marcus Aurelius, which came forward with a statement of with a cosmos that is of such great symmetry, you know, to be able to look at the stars, to be able to look at the galaxies, and to be able to identify that everything is revolving around, moons are revolving around planets with a perfect, you know, combination of mass and, you know, change of vector. And we say, well, all right, this is, and or we could look at why are our hearts still beating, or why have all of us, you know, been able to have a genetic code that is workable. All of these things are incredible miracles in themselves, and to identify the lack of a God in relationship to what amazing symmetries would happen. I mean, how many, you know, dice would we have to throw in order to be able to, or how many times would we have to throw 140 dice to be able to have them all come up as sixes every time? You know, and I mean, these are the kinds of things that you look at, not necessarily based in science, but certainly based in logic. And to also look and say it takes more faith to state that these things, that there isn't a God.
As a scientist, if I were asked to write the Bible, you can't describe what Jesus is with science.
Yeah.
You cannot. The people who lived at that time, or Hebrews, had the total freedom to say words in ways that describe what a wonderful Jesus is. And I can't do it as a scientist. I just say the book was not intended to be a science book. It's intended to be a book of theology to tell each of us what love is and why.
And you need to do that.
Yes.
Along those lines, because I was really fascinated by your comment about the mobile and the Noah and things. I mean, as a pastor, and we had the mobiles and the books for our kids, and we did Santa Claus, and we did Easter Bunny, you know, all those sorts of things. The problem is we stop. You know, so we take the Sunday school version of Noah's story, and when the kids get older, we don't take them further into the story to an adult level. I don't have any problem with the mobile. I have the problem with we stop there.
But we
stop there. So, you know, as a pastor, I deal with people who have third grade Sunday school level understands a whole lot of scripture, and nobody ever took them any further. With my confirmation kids, I used to give them a Christmas test. You know, things like how many wise men were there with me? How did Mary get to Bethlehem? She wrote about. And you'd go through and you'd say, we don't know how many, nothing ever says how many wise men there were. You know, we have no clue how Mary got. And they would be angry that the church had lied to them.
Yeah.
And
I kind of am.
That's right.
I mean, that, you know.
Yes. And that's my sense is we stop teaching.
Last comment.
The other thing too is that it is kind of a contradictory kind of thing, because how could you possibly explain that to a 2-year-old?
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be impossible. They couldn't wrap the mind around it.
And also back in the Genesis story, if we told it like it really was, they wouldn't have believed it.
Thank you.